All right, so I'm really excited to be here, and the talks earlier this week have given me a lot to think about in terms of not just, you know, what everybody's doing, but also sort of what I do and how that fits in. And so in the absence of any sort of strong direction about what I should talk about, this is what I chose. So I'm going to give kind of an overview, because my perspective is that I really enjoy working on systems that are out of control. And maybe that tells you more about me than it does about my biology, but I work on natural systems where we don't have feminine culture or genetic control over the system at all. And I think that brings some interesting insights to sort of the discussion that we're having here. So the talk that I put together is sort of, in the first part, a pretty broad overview of some things that I think are of interest, sort of from the natural microbial world, to the discussions we've been having, and then at the end, some tools that I've been using sort of in my own system that I study. So yeah, challenges, joys, and tools. So when you look at the diversity around you, and you are a birder, like my student Tessa, this is something we've been able to access for hundreds and hundreds of years, right? Thousands of years, people have been walking out and observing diversity. But the problem for microbiologists, which Bruce gave us an intro, is that this is our view of the natural world for the most part for much of our evolutionary time, right? And so it's not really surprising that we have such a dark picture of the diversity that's out there. And it's really only in the past few decades that we've been able to start filling in the blanks, which is not to say that there aren't beautiful examples of morphological, visible microbial forms that you can see right here. This is the microbiology zoo in Amsterdam. It's a beautiful shot of it here, where you can see all of the different cultured forms of microbes that are put together in this nice public display, right? But one of the things that Rachel gave us an intro to here, stealing a screenshot from one of her beautiful slides, was that, right, in the natural world, we can't culture most things. They're not simple, they're not reproducible, and they're not manipulable, which, when I think about what I do, sort of makes me feel like, oh God, right? But I think that this point that Sepa made was another thing that really caught my eye, which is what is not possible in biological systems and why not. And I have a radically different angle on this than sort of on the idea of constraining a system under our control, but really thinking about, in natural phenomena, what's possible, what can we predict from theory. And one of the things that I really enjoy thinking about is microbial metabolism. So to sort of shift from some of our evolutionary examples that I think Otto gave us a nice overview of yesterday, I'm going to talk a little bit about ecology and metabolism and some things that we can predict from sort of thermodynamics and theory, and things that we can't explain currently. So this is where we're going to start. We're going to go into the unknown, and just a little bit of background. We're going to talk about some things that seem impossible right now, but that we maybe need to find an explanation for. And then some possibilities found, some things that we predicted based on theory, but that took us until about 30 years ago to find. And then we're going to end with some tools that we use to sort of explore this area when you can't culture them or manipulate them, and a story about some of the work that I do. So I wanted to start here, and to get your brains moving, this is Octopus Springs. And this is the site that Norm Pace and Dave Stahl went out to in the mid-80s. And they decided to grab buckets of these microbial mats here because they were interested in studying thermophiles, but they were really, really hard to culture. And so their approach to doing this was to sequence the ribosome RNA. And so to get everybody's brain moving, I want you to talk to the people next to you for just 2-3 minutes and talk about why you think you would sequence ribosome RNA. And don't just tell me that it's because it's got good primers, because they didn't have PCR. So think about sort of big picture. Some of you, this may be, you know, total review. Other folks, maybe not. So just take 2 minutes and talk to the person next to you.
Say, I don't like the first
not a microbiology major and doesn't... Can I hear from somebody? All right, just anybody. How about a student? What were you guys talking about? I heard lots of noise.
We're all saying you should be talking.
You were saying that it's a good candidate because almost everything's going to have it.
Uh-huh. Good. Yeah, keep going. So it's a universal.
We were also saying that it's one of the genes that evolves more slowly. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to get like a saturation of differences. You'll be able to get some good resolution. We were saying that as well it's in multiple copies. So if it's something, if it was not really being expressed or if it was tricky to find, then you wouldn't be able to find it. But since it's in so many copies, it might be a little bit easier.
Beautiful. Yeah. I mean, so the approach that they were using, that's exactly right. Those were all the points I was trying to hit. So the approach they were using was to sequence the RNA molecules directly, right? And so they were sequencing by hand and sequencing the RNA molecules directly. And because there is a ribostructural RNA in each one of the ribosomes, it's one of the most abundant biomolecules in the cell, right? And so that made it a great target. It doesn't make it necessarily the best gene to have continued to explore the microbial world, but it does make it the first. And so the reason that I'm sort of harping on this sort of historical perspective is I think it's important to understand when you're coming into the field why we maybe chose something that doesn't have the best resolution. It has great resolution, but in many cases, you know, Otto showed you examples yesterday of things that are 100% identical at the 16S level, but that have drastic genomic differences. The reason we use this molecule is because of this reason. It was the first thing that we started to use, and it was experimentally accessible. And I think it highlights a nice point about doing microbial ecology in the natural world, which is that you're limited by the technologies that we have to explore them. And so this choice was made early on, but you know, since then, we've made a lot of progress. This is a tree of life built from 16S ribosomal RNA by my friend and colleague Laura Hugg, was working with the Banfield lab, and this is using not PCR amplified 16S sequences, but 16S sequences that were recovered from metagenomes. And one of the most profound things in this tree, first of all, everywhere that has a red dot against it has no cultured representatives. So let that soak in for a minute about the value of our model systems in many ways, right, in terms of being able to explain all of the diversity that's out there. We're blind to so much that is happening. But the really sort of kicker in this new tree of Laura's is this candidate phyloradiation that is bacteria, and we have never seen one of these cells, or maybe we've seen a few, but we have no idea what they even look like. And all of these sequences were things that we missed, even with the 16S ribosome RNA approach, because our PCR primers were unable to amplify it due to bias, right? And so just this is one of the things that I love about this field, is sort of how humbling it is to think about what's possible in biological systems. As I approach it as a biologist, I have no idea in many ways, right? And so I think this is where I'm really excited to have sort of more theoretical discussions, because I mean, to me, a whole group of organisms that could be that distantly related, we don't know anything about their physiology, really. And so it just really opens up a lot of possibilities to me about what might be possible or not possible. So now I wanted to show you an example of something that caught my imagination a few years ago, about something that seems impossible based on our current predictions. So this was a paper called Aerobic Microbial Respiration in 86 million-year-old Deep Sea Red Clay. So this was a research expedition where they went out to the South Pacific Gyre in the ocean, and they drilled down, and they brought up cores on deck that were going down about 30 or 40 feet, and they did oxygen concentration measurements with a microsensor that's able you sort of stick into anything. The tip can go down to a 10 micron resolution, but in this case they didn't need that, but they were measuring all the way down the core. And what they found was that they could measure respiration rates very, very deep in this core, which they could correlate to the age, and show that there were still things down there that had been buried with one packet of organic material 86 million years ago, and they were still breathing. Now, based on the amount of energy that was buried with them in their foodstuffs, that doesn't make sense. When you go through the metabolic calculations of how slowly they would have to be metabolizing, it breaks our models. And there are things that we can't explain about maintenance energy from these, which means either that their measurements are wrong, which might be possible, or that things that we understand based on cultures of E. coli and other things, where we measure many of these maintenance energy rates and get parameters for those types of models, are also wrong, right? And so it really pushes the bounds of what we can imagine that microbes might be able to do. And I put this up here because there's some folks at a group called CDEBI, the Center for Dark Energy Biosphere Investigations. They're sort of based out of USC, and they're doing some more work like this in terrestrial systems, mining down in mines and other sites, sort of really starting to get at some of this weird, deep microbial world that does things that we didn't even think were possible. So sort of opening up the idea that we need to think more broadly about many of our parameters.
Sorry, but what are you saying? That the laws of physics might be wrong?
No, I'm saying that not that the laws of physics might be wrong, but our laws of biology might be wrong, right? In that if you say that a cell, if you want to estimate the maintenance energy of a cell, right? We have parameters for what the turnover time for this, for how much things need to be repaired, and based on those estimates, this shouldn't be possible. So clearly there are things that are different about that, and being able to understand how organisms can conserve energy and really push the lower boundary of what you can do energetically is something we really don't understand because we don't have those organisms in culture.
I guess I just totally don't understand because, you're saying there's a possibility that they've been actively respiring for 86 million years while they didn't get any flow or movements.
Yes.
That does sound a bit unlikely, no?
Good. That's the point.
but this is like somebody tells you they've seen a UFO, right? Mm-hmm. So, yes, maybe. But maybe they didn't see right? So
yeah, absolutely. I mean, I put it up there to be deliberately provocative, right? Which is, in this case and in numerous other cases, there are examples in the microbial world of things pushing an energy limit of what we understand, right? And so I think this will be a really interesting conversation to continue. In particular, with some of the folks that are sort of more thinking about these types of metabolic models that are coming later. But I think the point that microbes do things that, based on our parameters from E. coli and Pseudomonas, we don't think they should be able to do. Right?
So, Lizzie?
Yes.
So, I'm also bothered by this. So, there couldn't have been oxygen down there forever. So, the oxygen must have been diffusing in from after the core was brought up?
No. The measurements, as I understand them, were that there is consistent oxygen that deep down. So they've been respiring extremely slowly for a very long time, right? So this could easily be wrong, right? But I put this up here as a provocative example of things that people are finding that we don't have an explanation for other than the data is wrong, which is possible, right? And we can look through this paper critically to think about that. But if it's not wrong, right, and there is oxygen that deep down and they have been respiring that slowly, then there's the possibility that organisms have the ability to slow down their metabolism beyond what we understand right now. They didn't do diversity analysis on this sample.
But there are microbes.
There are, yeah, they counted cells. They counted viable intact cells.
And how did they exclude the possibility that oxygen was introduced in the process of bringing the core up and sitting around on the deck?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think they had cores from other sites that were of similar depth where they didn't see that type of leakage. But, I mean, to really dig into it, we should sit down and look at this paper together. But the reason I'm putting some of these examples up here is to stimulate these types of discussions that I want to keep having with you all for the rest of the week.
Looks like a good candidate for a journal club in the afternoon.
Yeah. But. I put this up also because we had some really interesting discussions about it at a CDEBI meeting where a couple of people stood up and are like, this is garbage, this can't be true, right, because of parameters, blah, blah, blah. So I think it would be a really interesting discussion to have at some point. That's one example of things that we find that maybe they're wrong, but maybe they aren't, right? And if they aren't, like, how can we explain that biologically? Here's an example of something that people thought might be possible but had a hard time finding. Right? This is a paper from the late 70s called Two Kinds of Lithotrophs Missing in Nature. And this was Broda's prediction about a thermodynamic prediction about a metabolism that might be out there, a lithotrophic metabolism. And so this is sort of a cartoonish diagram of redox potential here, going from more reduced to more oxidized. And what I want you guys to take a second to think about is what would you breathe if you had no oxygen, and what would you eat if there were no sugars? And in fact, the only thing you had was this sort of pool of nitrogen down here. So I want you to talk to the person next to you, and keep you moving. Talk to the person next to you, and then we're going to come back together in about a minute or two, okay?
Cheese.
Cheese? You would eat cheese. And think about the fact that the thing that... Yeah, okay. Much more delicious. Okay, if you're feeling stuck, right? They will want to move from more reduced to more oxidized, right? And that's where the free energy is. So, hint. Okay. Does anyone have any ideas? Go in the Wayback Machine to Intro to Chemistry. How about some student ideas? Anybody?
We were going to eat ammonia.
You were going to eat ammonia? Okay. Good. Why?
Well, we didn't want to eat the dinitrogen because that's a really hard bond to break.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a mental nudge that's telling me that it's possible to eat ammonia. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's possible to eat it. Well, maybe you can. I don't know.
I know the bacteria in my fish tank eat ammonia.
Oh, nice. Okay, good. The bacteria in your fish tank eat ammonia. All right. So the key, I don't know if you guys can see that over here, right? The key here is thermodynamics, right? The idea that the free energy in the reaction, which you want to be negative, right? So it's exothermic. It releases energy because you need that to run your cell, right? Is the product of the number of electrons you transfer, the Faraday constant, and the redox potential difference between your electron donor and your electron acceptor, right? So exactly as you suggested, ammonia is a great electron donor because it's very reduced, right? Whereas nitrate or nitrite are pretty oxidized, right? If you look at these and you kind of squint a little bit, you can be like, it looks kind of like oxygen, right? That works to a reasonable degree, right? And so the prediction here was there was free energy to be had by going from ammonia to nitrate or nitrite, right? But nothing had ever been observed that did that. The fact that there was free energy there was, okay, great, that's nice chemistry, Broda, but we've never seen anything that could do anything like that in biology. In particular, there's a nice review that Heiskunen wrote about this process. He was one of the people that discovered it. He was saying they were talking about this paper, but they were like, well, we know that's not possible because there are no enzymes that can oxidize ammonia. Ammonia can only be oxidized, like the things in your fish tank, by using oxygen, because that's needed to break that bond, because it was thought to be very inert. Well, they were wrong. And what they found when they were looking at a wastewater treatment plant in Holland was that they saw stoichiometry of things that were going into this anoxic reactor that were consistent with this metabolism. We'd never seen an organism that did it. We had no idea what the enzymes could be that could catalyze it, but this process was happening. And the way that they figured that out without being able to culture it was they added, instead of 14N ammonia, they added heavy ammonia, or 15N ammonia. It's called stable isotope probing, or stable isotope labeling. And so they fed that into the reactor, and they found that it came out as mixed product nitrogen. So both of the 15Ns, one came from here, but then a 14N came from here. So they saw 29 mass nitrogen coming out of there. And there was no other explanation for that metabolism. That was in the sort of mid-90s that was found.
But why couldn't it have been nitrification and then denitrification from the isotopes?
From the isotopes. That is a good question, and I can't remember off the top of my head.
But somehow the numbers didn't add up.
Yeah, that 29N nitrogen is sort of diagnostic for that metabolism. I think because...
For that,
what?
for the catching any oxygen.
Oh, the whole thing was anaerobic. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. No, you can do this without oxygen. Oh, nitrification. Oh. No, nitrification. You need oxygen. Thank you.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's why.
I should know this, but where do the anaerobic bacteria get the carbon from?
That is a good question. I also don't know that because I don't work on animals. I think some of them are autotrophs, so I think some of them fix their own CO2. What happened here? Uh-oh, we've lost power. I mean, I can keep talking, but... Do we have our IT guy? Hello, IT guy.
Shake your computer.
All right, well, anyway, so it... Does someone want to alert IT guy that we're out here?
There's a number there.
Hold on. Let's try plugging it in.
Yeah, because this is still on up here.
Yeah, I don't know. It's most curious. All right, I'm going to let you guys, someone else run tech support. I'm going to keep talking.
I just wiggle the cables.
Okay, you keep wiggling the cables. So even though they found that metabolism, it took them probably 10 more years to find the organism that did it. And they still don't have that organism in culture. So they maintain it in a sort of continuous flow through bioreactor that they're using to culture it with limiting nutrients. But it's a very, very hard organism to culture. Yeah?
So in terms of the, I don't know very much about chemistry.
That's okay. That's why we're talking about it. I figured you didn't.
The question that you posed before about what would you breathe,
yeah.
What is taking the role of that?
What you are breathing is your terminal electron acceptor, which in that case is nitrate. So, yeah, so your electrons, so pretty much the message from this in terms of metabolism is that if you follow the electrons, you can find a lot about how a microbe is making a living, right? So you're going from a reduced source to an oxidized source. And so your food, in that analogy, is the thing that you are oxidizing, right? And that your breathing is the thing that you're reducing, right? In our sort of boring analogy for our own metabolism, right? You eat glucose, you rip your electrons off glucose, and you throw them onto oxygen at the end, right? And so it makes a nice point, I think, about microbes, because most of the diversity, right, their plumage is not in their feathers or in their morphology, it's in their chemistry, right? And this is where, you know, you can see, we've seen some of the examples of all of the genetic diversity that's out there for microbes, but the chemical diversity that they have in terms of their metabolism, I think, is even more amazing. In terms of the things that they're able to do. Let me think about what I was going to say next. I can have a look at my slides. Just keep talking. Let's see. Does anyone have any questions? Let's stop here. See if anyone has any questions. Because the next thing I was going to talk about is sort of some system and pretty pictures from my pink berries, which would be lovely to show slides for. Yeah?
What's the deal with the sulfur-eating bacteria? Mm-hmm. What are they eating and breathing?
Oh, good question. Okay, so if we were to draw, you can answer this question. So this is going from more reduced to more oxidized. So, and then, you know, other oxidized things here include oxygen and let's say acetate, lactate, things like that. So, think of some combinations of things that you could eat and breathe here while they deal with this disaster. So let's say that you saw sulfide that was disappearing in your system. What else might you want to measure? So they are consuming sulfide.
Carbon dioxide?
Yeah, maybe, maybe. Sulfate. You could measure sulfate, yeah. You might also want to measure oxygen, right? Because one of the biggest drops, if we were to do the actual measurements here, is to look at sulfide oxidation coupled with the reduction of oxygen, right? There's a lot of free energy there going from one side to the other. Similarly, sulfate-reducing bacteria use acetate or lactate and go to sulfate, right? So you can tell a lot just by looking at a table of these sort of redox potentials and playing mix and match and do a lot of predictions about what things might be able to eat. Yeah?
What was the other kind of lithotroph?
Oh, the other kind of lithotroph. That is a good question. It is, and I actually was looking for that when I was prepping for lectures last year, and it's an ammonia-utilizing phototroph. And I don't know that they found that. They found something, there was an interesting report of something similar to that recently, but I don't know that it was exactly what he predicted, so that one may still be out there. Yeah?
Yeah, I'm just going to reveal that I know zero chemistry, but...
That's okay, I was not comfortable with eigenvalues, so...
Is it possible to oxidize using molecules that don't contain the atom oxygen?
Yes. Maybe. That's an interesting question. Hold on.
Iron 3.
Yeah, iron 3. Thank you. Yes. So, yes. But it has to. There has to be something to oxidize the iron and keep it in that state. So it is somehow related, I mean, inadvertently. But
yeah, iron 3 can be used as a terminal electron acceptor.
Yes, exactly. Yes. So, yes, it's possible.
Anybody doing that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of really interesting work on iron reducers. Yeah, and iron oxidizers. I mean, iron biogeochemistry is fascinating because you can go in both directions depending what else you have around. You can either oxidize it or you can reduce it. Have we given up? Here with the. How many pairs are there?
Yeah.
Pretty much anything. I'm going to put this screen up while it's not working because I need the board. Pretty much anything that has energy available. So this was, if there's a buck to be made, microbes will make it. So the constraint, which, again, is something I don't think we actually really understand. The constraint right now that you would put it at is something around 20 kilojoules per mole is sort of what you would say is the minimum energy threshold.
The delta G
that you need is around 20 kilojoules per mole.
And why it's 20 kilojoules per mole?
I'm way out of my depth here now, but that's sort of come up with by the minimum energy requirements for maintenance energy in the cell in order to build all the biomolecules. And if you go through and sort of do the tallying of like, okay, you know, you need to make proteins, you need to make DNA, you need to make membrane lipids, and then you can sort of tally up an ATP count, and then sort of pulling that back to the energy available for one ATP molecule to be able to do that.
But the definition of heat at the moment is just source of energy as opposed to source of carbon.
So this is a very interesting thing. And the reason I phrase it that way as heat as opposed to oxidize is that I think we have very little intuitive understanding. We get our electrons and our carbon and our nitrogen from mostly all the same place, right? Your salad, your hamburger, right? Whereas microbes have the ability to get that in completely separate pathways, which Boris makes is a very nice point, right? So if you are doing, so the question, where do they get their carbon, right? Some of them have to fix their own carbon from CO2, so they can live on sort of the barest bones of minimal media if you let them, fixing nitrogen from the atmosphere, fixing carbon dioxide into their biomolecules. Or they could be mixotrophs, some of that, some of the other, uptaking other things. So I had not planned to spend this much time on metabolism, but, you know, given our unexpected detour, I'm happy to keep talking about it.
So about that paper that was controversial.
Yeah.
So in general, is it really reasonable to expect that? So we have, let's suppose we have these numbers to expect that we can actually... So let's put it differently. So what is the error that we should expect on these things, considering that these numbers come from one atmosphere, pH 7, and so on, and nature things can be in flux, they're not in equilibrium, so chemical potential changes.
Yep.
So it's to be expected that something...
Yeah. So Otto makes a great point, which is that... Okay, here we go. Like your worst nightmare qualifying exam. So they can do the delta G, which is delta G standard. Oh God, what is it? Minus RT ln K. So you can adjust this, like Otto said, for temperature. You can also adjust it for pressure. And then K, which is your reaction quotient, which is basically just a ratio of reactants to products, right? So this is a really important place where I stalled in my microbial ecology class for about 3 lectures accidentally this past fall, talking about how ecological interactions can change the very basics of the chemistry of the energy that's available, right? Yeah. So in many cases, you'll find that if you allow a product to build up, it doesn't just poison you. It completely changes the reaction chemistry so that there's actually no energy available anymore, right? So it can be more than just toxicity. It can be about whether that reaction is even thermodynamically favorable. So the example that people use is a symbiosis that occurs between ciliates and methanogens. And methanogens, they will draw down, so the ciliates are fermenting carbohydrates, and they will produce, as they ferment, hydrogen as a waste product. Hydrogen builds up. And at some point, that fermentation, the energy flips from being favorable to unfavorable based on the pressure of that hydrogen gas. So the solution that the ciliates have is that they have a symbiont, the methanogen, that eats hydrogen and draws that down. And so when you do that, you can push it much closer to the thermodynamic edge in terms of things that are able to be eaten, right? So it's an example of where sort of ecology runs into chemistry in this way that
I'm wondering. Maybe this electron tower is good at telling us what is possible but not what's not possible.
Right. Well, I mean, again, it can tell you all of those things if you tweak the right parameters, right? So that I think, oh goodness, what is happening here? This is really dire. This is going to be a whole lecture about metabolism. We had a lot of places we were going to go other than this.
A tutorial,
yeah. Yeah, so does anyone have any other questions?
Yes.
Yes.
So there is thermodynamics, such as delta G, delta H.
Yeah.
But I wonder how kinetics is important in microbiology, because I mean there is all this protein which catalyzes the reaction, but often what is limiting the process is you manage to get enough food from this substrate fast enough to feed you.
Yeah.
So is there some work doing in this?
Yeah, way? Yeah. So that's a really this is chapter 2, right? Is the kinetics. It's not about how much energy you get per molecule, maybe that's not what they see. What you said is right, right? There's a time dimension. So it's how much you get per molecule per minute that is really what matters, right? In terms of, if you think about, there's a great quote that Stanley Falco had that said, this is my email signature, the obvious thing. Can someone help me here? What is my email signature?
The obvious goal of any bacterium is to become bacteria.
Thank you, Tessa. Right, the obvious goal of any bacterium is to become bacteria. So for microbiology 101, bacterium is singular, bacteria is plural. Okay? And so you want to multiply. If you want to multiply, that's something that has a time dimension, right? And you need to, how fast you can multiply depends on your energy flux, not just the thermodynamic potential. And so that's a beautiful point. And Steve Zinder had something that he called the Walmart model, which was that it didn't matter if you had a great profit margin. If you could move millions of those things per minute, you were still going to make a ton of money, right? And so there definitely are really beautiful examples of things that sort of in ecological theory you might call more R versus K strategists, right? Things that optimize for fast, sort of wasteful, fast growth, right? They maybe aren't most efficiently extracting all of the energy that could be used in that molecule.
Sorry, but I'm very confused, because I thought the discussion was what kind of different energy sources can you live? Mm-hmm. Right, and so if you're a bacterium and you found out a new source that nobody else is using, it doesn't matter at all how slow you are, right?
True.
You can still make a living on this thing.
That is a beautiful example of where it might pay to be something that's doing it really efficiently, right, because no one else can do it. And there are plenty of examples where things do grow very, very slowly, right? But then depending on your competitive niche, right, so this sort of gets into how you define your niche space, right? Is your niche space that you're going to run in and eat all the pizza before anybody gets a chance to have it? Or are you going to, like, most efficiently extract all the energy from that pizza, right? And so it depends really on the competitive landscape in terms of where you're going to see those types of things that are beneficial, right? And I think exactly what you pointed out is, oh, we're back in business. Okay, but my computer is gone. Oh, my God. Okay. So what you pointed out, I think, is a really, really good point, which is that if you can acquire a genetic potential that no one else has, right, to do some hard chemistry, then it pays to invest in it, even if you can't do it very fast, right? And you see examples of both these things evolving. Yay! There we go. Okay. So we're definitely not getting the second half of what I was going to talk about, but that's okay. So the story that I was going to tell you to sort of show some examples of tools where we are trying to explore the microbial world is from the pink berry system that I've done a bunch of work on. So I wanted to show you some pictures of the marsh where we find them. These are these intertidal clearings that I sketched out before. It's a little nicer here. These are these muddy pools. And what's really cool about this habitat is that the you find oxygenic phototrophs that co-occur in this same pond. So the chemical environment varies dramatically over the course of the day. So for part of the day, there's sulfide in this sort of muddy water up about 3 centimeters into the water column. But then at peak light, when the sort of algae are doing their thing, you get super saturation of oxygen at the surface there. So you get this really big change. The chemocline where sulfide resides migrates up and down. And I guess I should say the sulfide that's being produced here in the marsh is coming from sulfate-reducing bacteria that are then sort of seeping their waste products that comes up out of that stinky, rotten egg mud. So this is what you find beneath the surface of this pond, and it's honestly what hooked me on this system from the beginning because I just think they're beautiful. This is a dime for scale. And you can see here that they range in size from about 1 to, there are no big ones in this shot, but they could be up to 1 centimeter across. Now, this is a picture that Otto just gave me from his colleague at Harvard, Scott Chmielinski, where you can see the beautiful sort of three-dimensional structure of these aggregates. And what you're seeing here, this is about 1 millimeter or 2 millimeters across, and these islands here are all clumps of the phototrophic purple sulfur bacterial cells. And one of the things that I liked about this system is that it's got this really skewed diversity, right? So this is showing you on the y-axis the abundance and on the x the species rank based on taxonomic units that we made from 16S sequencing. So on this side, you can see here that we've got a handful of really abundant taxa, but it is a natural system, so you've got a long tail of things that are sort of sticking onto the outside. And then this is showing you here the sort of breakdown of the different taxonomic groups. And what I really want you to focus on for the purpose of this talk are these two taxa here, the purple sulfur and the sulfate reducer, which make up about 60 to 70% of the sequences that we recover. So this is sort of the cartoon of what we think these organisms might be doing. And I'll emphasize that we didn't have either of these in culture when I was doing this work. The purple sulfur bacteria is related to organisms that can fix CO2, that are phototrophs, and that oxidize sulfide to sulfate instead of like what green plants use with water. So they're using this as their source of reducing equivalents. We didn't know if this organism did this activity, but it was a prediction based on its closest relatives. And then the other dominant organism in there, the sulfate reducer, catalyzes sulfate reduction to produce sulfide, right? And again, this was just a prediction based on its relatives. And so this sort of set up this idea that you could have a very closely coupled sulfur cycle within these aggregates. And I was interested in this for a number of reasons. One, it was a system that was natural and out of our control, but had sort of simple enough diversity that we might be able to get a handle on some of the molecular and chemical interactions that were happening in here. And two, this type of very closely coupled cycling is something called cryptic biogeochemical cycling. It's something where you might not be able to measure the intermediates, but there's a turnover that's happening, and it's important for the sort of behavior of the larger system. It's not shown here in this one. We don't actually know what their electron donor is, but typical electron donors might be something like glycolate or lactate, sort of fatty acids, things like that. Where would those come from? That's a great question. So we think that that is probably coming from a breakdown product from the polysaccharide goo that's produced. So if you look here, you can't see it quite as well in this image, but the space between all of these is filled with a clearish goo that we think is sort of polysaccharides. So we think that the breakdown products of that are probably what's doing it. But there's definitely several more links in the food chain before it would get to them. It could also just be that they're soaking them up from the environment. It's definitely not a closed system, so it's sort of something else to think about. What holds them together? Also don't know. What I can tell you is that when you put them in 6-molar urea, they blow apart. So we think that it has something to do with the polysaccharide stuff. But they're actually pretty hard to break apart. We don't know that much about it. So one of the first things that we did was to do metagenomic sequencing on these aggregates, with the goal being to assemble and bin the genomes to which enzymes, gene sequences came from the different species. And I'm taking here probably about 4 years of work and jamming it into one slide to show you that, you know, we saw metabolic pathways here where each of these are the different steps in sulfide oxidation and sulfate reduction, and that we found homologs to the genes that we knew carried this out, right? So this was some of our evidence for this portion of this story. We found genes that would predict that this type of cycling might happen. But an important point about genomics and metagenomics is to always question what you find, right? Because it's a hypothesis about something that they might be doing and not, you know, proof positive that it's what's happening in the environment. So we were really interested in trying to test this, and my first very naive experiment was to put a bunch of berries in a bottle and to measure the sulfide concentration to see if we could catch one of the intermediates in that cycle, right? And I was very disappointed by our initial results because nothing happened. We left them in the bottle, and we never saw them produce any sulfide whatsoever. But we found that when we fed them sulfide at about 1 millimolar concentration, compared to the abiotic control, the berries chewed the sulfide down, oxidizing it to almost nothing within about 2 days. So we were able to see that they were net sulfide consumers, but we never saw any sulfide coming back out.
Light involved?
Yes, there is light. These are phototrophs.
Right.
So the reason that they're pink is from their photosynthetic pigments that they're using. Yeah.
You're supplying a bottle with light during this experiment.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. These were in full spectrum bulbs. You can also culture them under 850 nanometer LEDs, which is kind of cool. But yeah. So they use very long wavelength light, which is why they're pink and not green like plants. So we had a hint about why this might be by looking at the spatial organization of the species within the aggregates. And so this is a fluorescent micrograph that we've taken after we stained it with fluorescence in situ hybridization. So this is a method where you have a DNA probe that hybridizes to the ribosomal RNA, which we've already established is really abundant in the cell, right? So it's a good target. So you use a fluorophore. In this case, our fluorophore was green. And it is specific to the 16S sequence for our sulfate-reducing bacteria. The nice thing about the phototrophs was that their photosynthetic pigments autofluoresced, so we didn't need to label those specifically in order to find them. But what we found here was a very close association between these two cell types, where you could see always, or more or less always, the sulfate reducers were nestled right up next to the purple sulfur bacterial partners. And this to us suggested a possibility for why we weren't measuring that intermediate in this cycle, because as soon as sulfide might be getting produced here, it was getting consumed by the other partner. In this sort of tightly coupled system. And you can see here, you can't at all see here, but if you could, imagine a world where you could see that this is stained blue in here. So we have DNA stains for many, many other cell types, and we have genomes now for about 10 other bacteria in this system. But sort of looking at these two, we were interested in this close coupling. Does anyone have any questions? I stop here for a second.
So the previous measurements with the hydrogen sulfide, if you do it in the dark, and you see production?
No, you don't. No, even when you do it in the dark. So that graph that I showed you was on a light-dark cycle. So it was 14 hours in the light, then it was in the dark. And I thought we were going to see spikes of sulfide occurring in the dark, but you never do. And part of the reason is that these purple sulfur bacteria cells, I don't know if you noticed in those cartoons earlier, they have sort of molecular lunch boxes that they stuff full of sulfide. So as they oxidize sulfide, they'll store elemental sulfur as an intermediate. So I think that what's happening at night is they might not be oxidizing it for photosynthesis, but they are grabbing that sulfur molecule and keeping it for later inside these elemental sulfur granules that they have in their cells, which will be important later.
Do you measure oxygen?
Yes, we've measured oxygen. That's a good point. I meant to mention that. So if you take those oxygen microsensors and you have a berry here, an oxygen microsensor, and you run it through the berry, you can do a profile and show that the center of the aggregates become anoxic very quickly. And so it goes from oxic to anoxic. And the respiration that's happening in that aggregate can keep the berry anoxic even when the surrounding water is oxygenated, which we think is part of the force for why they might be forming these granules, which is to sort of partition themselves away from the oxygen that's competitively produced.
No, I meant, okay, so you don't see the production of hydrogen sulfide, but you may see the consumption of oxygen.
Yes, they definitely will be consuming. Well, those experiments that I showed you were all, they were done anoxic. So there was no oxygen in the overlying water. We can talk about it later.
Yep.
Yes?
Can you saturate the lunchbox?
Yes, you can. Yeah. And what's beautiful about this system is you can visually see when they're saturated versus depleted. Because elemental sulfur is very refractile, so they kind of have a chalky appearance when they're sort of full and stocked up. And when they're sulfur starved, they become really sort of a clear, sad-looking purple. So yeah, you can saturate that. They can only store so much. That's a good question. Anything else?
When they're saturated, do you then see the spikes?
That would be an interesting experiment. We haven't done that. But we generally chose ones that were pretty healthy. So that's a really good question, and I don't know the answer to that. I'd like to know. All right, I'm going to forge ahead for few more minutes here. Okay, so I was really interested in trying to track this cycle, and I introduced a technique earlier of using stable isotopes to try and track cycling when you can't culture the microbes, and here's an example where we use that again. So in this case, we used a pretty unusual stable isotope probe of 34 sulfur. Normal sulfur is sulfur 32. So we used 34 sulfate with the idea that if this activity was happening, it would produce a pool of heavy sulfide that then might get consumed and stored in their elemental lunch boxes by the purple sulfur bacterial cells. And we plan to look for this signal using a pretty cool technology. Oh, and the other important bit here was that this elemental sulfur can only come from this direction of the cycle. So the purple sulfur bacterial cells here never incorporate oxidized sulfur because why would they? They already feed off this reduced pool, and for all of their biomolecules, they need it for amino acids in this form, so there was really no reason to do sort of that type of assimilation from the oxidized pool. So we also included this label, but I'm not going to talk about that. So this is how we set up the incubations. This is the nice thing about this system compared to other wild systems, right? We can go out, we can pick them up in this relatively reduced complexity system, wash them free of all the sediment, and then run some incubations to sort of probe at what they might be doing. So we put them here in these bottles with our isotope chemicals spiked in. And then we eventually analyze them on this machine that's called a nanometer scale, the nanosims, or nanometer scale secondary ion mass spectrometry. And what this does is it lets you look at the elemental composition of the cells at a single cell resolution. So the way it works is it takes a beam of cesium ions and it focuses it down to a spot size of about 50 nanometers, so subcellular resolution. And then as you blast that energized beam of cesium ions that I'm sure someone here understands much better than I do, it blows apart your sample as its component secondary ions. And then you focus each of those. You can focus up to 7 at a time. And you measure the mass of those ions that are coming off. And what's cool about this is as you raster it spot by spot across your sample, you can generate a heat map of the abundance of all of these different ions. And so that's what we did, measuring the two ions of sulfur here and then also carbon at the same time. And so what you're going to see here is this is an overlay image of the carbon, nitrogen, and sulfur. And what you're seeing in these sort of ghostly shadows are the shapes of those round purple sulfur bacterial cells. And then in the left-hand image, this is showing you the ratio of heavy to light sulfur. And our controls, where we added a regular sulfur compound, were all blue. And so anywhere that you're seeing this warmer colors are places where that heavy label was accumulating inside these cells. So this was sort of our visual evidence that we were seeing our label being incorporated from this type of cycling. So we'd seen this activity, we'd seen it in, incorporated, and we did another control where we added an inhibitor called molybdate, which is a sulfate analog. And what it does is it knocks out the activity of this sulfate reducer. And in data I'm not going to show you, we found that when we did that, we no longer saw any incorporation into these cells. So we were able to sort of knock it in and knock it out in terms of the activity. So that's kind of one example of how we were sort of exploring chemical activity. And the thing that I'll tell you about these experiments was that I set up this trial with 300 different conditions, and I was like, great, we'll run through all of them, we'll see, you know, what affects it in different ways. And then I found out that it took us 3 days to analyze 2 samples. And so it's not a high throughput technique, but it sort of gets at some interesting things about how hard it is to do these type of measurements when you can't get the organisms in culture, which is definitely something we're trying to do. And it is, yes?
Do berries grow in your culture, and what's the doubling?
Berries, so I have maintained them in the lab on like mud for about 6 months, so I can kind of keep them in a mesocosm habitat. I don't know how much they actually change. I haven't really tracked the, so sequenced them or tracked the species composition over that time.
During these measurements, do they grow or do they...
That's a good question. We don't see any appreciable changes over the course of those. We did those incubations for about 5 days. So you probably maybe do get some cell divisions, but I don't think, we don't see any macroscopic evidence for growth. Anyone have any other questions before I move on?
So then how old are these berries?
That is such a good question. I really, really want to try and date them. They're not seasonal, so we find them there at all times of year. Including, I think, Rachel and Otto were there this past February, which is a much less fun time to be sampling in the marsh. So you definitely find them all the time. We find some that are over a centimeter across, and I think those are probably really old, although it could just be something about their environment. But we have really no way of dating them, but it's something I'm interested in doing. So.
Have you done any, like, field experiments, like setting up, removing the berries from a plot or like seeding berries into a part of...
No, the answer is no, we haven't done that, but I'd love to. I think that would be really, really interesting, yeah, in terms of things to do. In fact, that one of my students was designing like a hypothetical project this past spring, and that was exactly the experiment they wanted to do.
So this might just show that I'm totally misunderstanding, but so the reason you did this was to ask whether they're doing this, or it's known that they're running this reaction, and you were doing this to check that you can confirm that
they're running. That's a good question. Yes, so we had genes that told us they could do it, and we had relatives that said, in culture of these organisms, that said they do this type of metabolism. But whether or not this activity was actually happening at this close a scale in the environment was not something that we knew. That's a great question, because it's not obvious from the cartoons that you can draw, but there's a leap there between potential for activity and the actual activity. Yes?
Can most of the partners be found planktonic?
That is a good question. Yes, but we don't know much about them. So we've measured the overlaying water in those ponds, and we found microscopic clumps that contain both partners, and we've found some of them alone. What we don't know is whether those are physiologically active, so they may have just like broken off and be hanging out and be on their way out, or they could be the seeds that start everything, but we really know very little about how they form. We have some data for the purple sulfur bacteria that I think we could look at in the marsh.
Do you know the genetic diversity within?
Ah, well, that would ruin Otto's talk next week.
Next year, actually.
That's something we're really excited about looking at. So I'll get at that question in a minute. Right now. So these are some of the future directions. This is another one of Scott's beautiful images of them. But, you know, that was kind of the very first sort of glimpse of what we were... That there was an obvious hypothesis that people had been sketching just based on their relatives for years. But what other metabolic interactions or co-adaptations there might be of them, I really wanted better genomes to study them. And so this is a project that Otto and I are working on now, where Rachel went out to the marsh and sorted 500 of these aggregates into individual pods, and we're sequencing them across 3 different marsh sites where we found. And what Otto's going to show you next week, I think...
Next year.
Next year? You're not going to show them the biography data?
We talked about something similar yesterday night.
Okay. Well... So it looks like we're seeing some really beautiful signal of biogeographical patterns in terms of the diversity, which is work that his postdoc Gabe, who he says is a Jedi, is doing to show that there seem to be locally, whether they're locally adapted or just isolated, we don't know. But we're really excited about looking at that sort of pattern. So that's sort of a future direction for where we're taking this. Some of the other things that we're doing with this system is also to look at patterns of stability. So how often do you find the same two partners occurring? Or are there places where you may have had the loss of one partner and someone else subbing in? So sort of looking at community dynamics in that way. And then we're also using the new metagenomic data set that I have to look at predator-prey dynamics, looking at viral populations and then the CRISPR defenses to viral attack in these genomes, and sort of looking at that sort of things. And then we're also interested in looking at sort of evidence for horizontal gene transfer and gene flow among this population. And I'm going to stop here. I have basically an entire other thing. Oh, well, yeah, this is for the rest of my lab, and where we're trying to go with some of this is we're not going to just study berries. Maybe we will study berries forever, but we also want to study some other things. Because even if I could take the system apart completely and put it back together, I really enjoy working on things that are mostly not under control. And so I really want to work on some of these marine snow aggregates and looking at sort of the particulate dynamics and using some of these same tools that we've developed to pick apart what's happening in some more of these natural systems. And so I have a whole other section on metagenomics and what makes metagenomics hard and some of the sort of things we've done in this space to develop better tools, which I blew over in one slide. But I think what we should do right now is have a coffee break and then get back together because this is going to take more than 15 minutes. So you guys look like you could use a break. So I'll stop there. Maybe we could get together at some point if folks are interested in talking more about sort of the techniques of how you can put genomes together, some of the challenges to doing that, because I think one of the places that we are right now with metagenomics is that we're getting to the point where with these natural populations and stuff that I think Paul alluded to, we're able to get enough sequence data from these now that doing evolutionary experiments and ecological experiments on natural systems is becoming much more accessible. And so this is something I spent a lot of time working on, and I'd be happy to talk more about sort of the technology behind some of those things, in particular since we're going to be using some of the nanopore stuff later.
So the interesting thing is always hard, right? What makes metagenomics possible?
Yeah.
Maybe more forward-looking.
Yes, yeah, but it sets up that problem. So.
All right. Lizzie, but, you know, it's only 10:30, and we, I think, can do another 20 minutes or half an hour, can you?
Yeah, okay, I'd be happy to do that. Do we want to take a short break and then come back, or?
They'll break anywhere between the talks, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, about another 25 minutes for you, then we take a break.
Okay. Yeah, I think I'm happy to keep going.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
Are the berries heritable?
That is a very good question. We don't know how they form. So, we find the same two species co-occurring over time. So we can go back year after year and we still find the same two that are in there and a handful of others that appear to be stable members of the community. How that's transferred, whether the, you know, one aggregate breaks into two or where they all form de novo, we really don't know, but that's a great question. We might be able to get at some of that looking at the population data, but we haven't gotten there yet. Any other questions before we charge ahead? Yeah.
I have a question. First of all, how prevalent is that berries phenomena in general, like, is it very specific to salt marshes? And second, how do you think this job or this work is generalized beyond this?
Yeah, I know, that's a great question. So I think to answer your first question, how general, like how frequent are they? We've only found them in three sites. So we've never found these sort of particular species or even aggregates that look like this much of anywhere else. We think it has something to do with the, I mean, you find mats and things like that, but they're much more complex. So you find sort of sticky things that do similar chemistry in many places, but this particular morphology is pretty unique to this site. In terms of how it's more generalizable, that's a great question. There's a couple particular examples, but I think the most zoomed out answer is that looking at metabolic interactions between microbes in a natural system is really hard. And so I think being able to develop tools to do that is really helpful. And beyond just tools, the message is
One that Colleen Kavanaugh had a great example for is about the standing pools of a chemical in the environment. So we can't measure sulfide being produced in this system ever, but sulfide is really important. And the analogy that Colleen used was that the beer that is left in the fridge is not usually the one that is being drunk the most often, right? So it's the things you can't keep in the fridge that are really important to the ecology of the system, right? And so looking at just measuring a concentration doesn't tell you how important it is. In fact, a high concentration suggests that no one really wants it or that there's a lot of production. So I think sort of measuring the unmeasurable chemicals or finding ways to use the microbes to tell you what chemicals are important in that system can tell you a lot about that ecology. So I think that's the other thing. And then I'm hoping it will tell us something about co-adaptation, but we haven't really gotten there yet. So there's some other particular examples of places where we see this type of activity happening on particles. In this type of system, right, where the amount of carbon that forms into these globules and sinks to the deep sea, whether these get broken back up and respired determines how much CO2 would get re-released, right? So the dynamics on those particles and being able to figure out who's feeding what and what's that food web are really important in sort of a more global scale. All right. Okay, so to set up some of the things that are possible in metagenomics, I start by sort of highlighting some of the challenges that we have as a field to understand sort of what some of the new technologies are letting us do. And so I used this analogy earlier, but if you think about genome assembly as a puzzle, right, metagenomic assembly is knocking over your bookshelf of puzzles and then trying to put them all together all at one time, which unsurprisingly is hard. And it's not just hard for puzzle piecers, but it's also hard for computers. So this is computationally a non-trivial problem, right? So this gives us to problem number one. Metagenomic assembly is hard and complicated, and one of the reasons, well, there's lots of reasons, but we won't go into that right now. And then binning. So this is the process of figuring out which pieces belong to whom, right? So figuring out how to partition things back to their original cell or species of origin. And there are a number of things we could spend a whole, 50-minute lecture on binning and the challenges for binning. But figuring out the source of those organisms can be particularly challenging, especially when there's nothing in the database that looks like your organism. Or in interesting cases, like when there's horizontal gene transfer, where you have a new piece of DNA that's been stuck in, and it's not phylogenetically related to the rest of your genome. So how do you figure out that that piece belonged with all the other ones, particularly when it's fragmented because your assembly is hard, right? And then the third thing is strain variation. And this is something that I think is very great interest to this audience in particular, which is being able to get at what is the natural variation in bacterial populations. Now, the problem with that from a metagenomic perspective is that strain variation breaks metagenomics assemblers. And the reason for this is that if you have two species that are very, very similar through their whole genome, right, and then a region where they diverge, the assemblers don't know which way to go. Right? And so you come to a fork, or sometimes a tangle or a knot, right, in your assembly graph, and you're unable to keep piecing it together. And so figuring out ways to get at structural variants and other things involved in strain variation, right now, if you are trying to assemble a metagenome from a very diverse population, oftentimes all you end up with is shrapnel if you're using short reads. So these are sort of some of the main challenges that are present in the field. Before I go ahead, does anyone have any questions? Okay.
I guess those are repeats.
Yes, repeats. Yes, that's the other one. Yeah, it's sort of falling into a similar type of problem as strain variation. So, yes.
So if you use short reads, what's your context size distribution on the big variant?
We'll get there. So for the genomes that I showed you earlier, that was like a 2010 era Illumina genome, and they were, the N50 was like 20 kb. For that genome, so it was in 1,000 contigs, 20 kb, but you'll see the more complete one. So for this work that I'm doing, in case we run out of time, I wanted to just acknowledge all the folks that have been involved in the unpublished work that I'm going to talk about. Started in my graduate lab with Jonathan Eisen and involved collaborations with Pacific Biosciences and Moleculo and some other folks. So this is the data set that we had, and our goal was to use long read sequencing to get at some of the problems that happen when you can't span those repeats or other things. So I just want to introduce the data set that we had. So our first opportunity to do this came with working with Moleculo, and we generated these reads that were 2 to 20 kilobases long with a technology that uses the Illumina sequencing platform but generates synthetic long reads. And for the sake of time, I'm not going to go into the details of how they do that, but it's essentially a serial dilution process, and I'm happy to show you the technology in a minute. And then as a control, we also generated HiSeq and MiSeq data that was sort of 100 to 250 kb, or base pairs, I wish it was kb. And then we also did an experiment on a separate aggregate, because we'd run out of DNA, using Pacific Biosciences, where we generated sort of the similar length reads, but a very different type of platform for doing that sequencing. This is telling you how much data that we have. So how long is long? If I were a commander-in-chief, I might just say it's huge and move on, but let's look at some data. So this is showing you the size distribution here of the molecular reads. So you can see we've got a peak around 8 kb, and then this is just an artificial cutoff because we just stopped doing it below 2 kb. So they're quite long. And here is the PacBio data. It's a little bit shorter, between sort of a peak around 4,000 nucleotides in length.
Are these circular consensus ones, or is
no? Yes, these were circular consensus ones, but we didn't use them that way. We used the subreads directly. So one of the first things we were interested in was just a basic sanity check. Do we recover similar taxa? This is a zoom in on one particular clade. The Chromaceales is the family that contains the purple sulfur bacteria, and these are a handful of the other species we find. And in each case here, you see the long read library matched with its short read control, and you see that based on the read identification against the database, we recover similar percentage of sequences. So this is just the percentage of those sequence reads that were classified, these two different ones.
This is just alignment-based, so blasting them?
Yeah, this is just blast alignment-based, yeah.
These are two communities? The replicates are different communities?
There was sample one and sample two, which is an unfortunate feature of the fact that these were experiments of opportunity. So ideally, we would have done this all from one DNA extraction, but we didn't know that PacBio was going to give us 42 smart cells of sequencing when we started. So we used up all our DNA, and then they were like, hey, we think we can beat the molecular technology. Do you want us to try? And I was like, well, I don't have any more DNA. So we had to extract more, and then we had another paired library. So these are two different biological communities.
So these are all gamma proteins?
No. This is just one zoom in. What you can't see on the bottom here is that says percentage of classified gamma proteobacteria reads. So we have the sulfate reducers, our deltas, and then we have a handful of other genera in there as well.
Okay, so you're just showing.
This is one example. Yeah.
How much didn't align to anything in the reference?
That's a good question. There's a fair bit that's unclassified because those types of blast-based classifiers are terrible. So. Any other questions? I think I saw another hand over here. Okay. So what this is showing you is the alignment of the read. So at the top, you're seeing a reference genome, and then we have aligned each of these sequence reads to that genome. And these bars are showing you the coverage or the depth of reads, so the number of times we've sampled it with one of these sequences. And then the little black bars here are showing you places where we have an error, or an insertion deletion error in particular. And so what you can tell looking at this just visually is that the molecular reads are very, very accurate, and the PacBio reads are much more error prone. But the thing that's really beautiful about the PacBio reads is that, so we have read accuracy, and the thing that's beautiful about these is you can get consensus accuracy. Because these reads are, the errors are random, they buffer out with the greater sequence depth that you have. And the PacBio data, you can't really see it in this region, which I chose so we had reads, but there are places where the molecular data drops out and you have no coverage because of the PCR bias. And then in this case, where the PacBio is much more even, so it samples things in a much more unbiased way. Okay, so what can we assemble? This answers your question from earlier. So here we're comparing our short read data with the molecular library and the PacBio. And what you're seeing on the left-hand side is our total assembly size. So if we take all the contigs that we could assemble and then sort of add up their length all together, this is our sequence space. So the short read assembly clearly does much better. And the reason that I'll tell you that it does that is that We sequenced two Illumina lanes of data from this, which is something, it's like 60 gigs of data from these berries. And from these, it was much harder. There's comparably, there's like a fraction less data. This is about 280 megabases of data, and this even less, because it's so much more expensive to generate these long reads with the current technology platforms. So we can sample much more deeply, but you'll see here in a second the trade-off. So on the log scale here on the right is the number of contigs that this assembles into, showing you that whereas you do sort of go from 30, about 100 more megabases of sequence space, but it's fragmented into more than 10,000 contigs. And so that's really the trade-off, is that you can sample much more stuff, but it's in many, 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 many more pieces. Whereas this one was in 169 contigs, which frankly you can bin by hand. You don't need any sort of fancy binning algorithms in order to do that. And then the real question is, how long were these sequences? Yes, yeah.
Isn't the left y-axis and the right y-axis coordinates? Like the size, the total size and the length size?
Well, not necessarily, right? Because if each genome was in one piece, right, then you could have, you know, all of the genomes. I mean, in part, right? Probably it does. But it also reflects the fact that the contigs are much smaller in size. So you have many, many, many more tiny, tiny contigs, as opposed to what you want to have, which is a complete genome from beginning to end in a single contig. Does that make sense? Sort of? Yes. Maybe. We can talk about it more. Yes.
I mean, I guess the concern here is this might be okay for your system because the diversity is sort of weighted towards a couple species. But if you have a more even community with something like this, you're going to be missing a ton of the diversity in the system.
Yes.
You don't get the coverage that you need for the longer read.
Yes, yeah. No, that's absolutely true. And that's the reason that they were willing to sequence something as silly as my little berries, was because this is an unusual feature of the system. So I think the way to look at... So just to make sure everybody understands the question is, if it weren't as simple or skewed a system as the berries, would this still work? Would you be able to assemble anything? What I can tell you is that Julie O's group at Mouse Lab, Jackson Labs, has done this on a skin microbiome sample. And so they did this with PacBio. And they found they were able to assemble some stuff, even from a pretty complex sample. But again, they sequenced a ton of stuff, and it was really, really expensive. So how useful this is for assembling each of these data types independently is unclear, which is why the project that I'm excited about having you guys do is to say, how little of this sequencing can you do in order to make your assemblies better? And I think that's very much an open question, and Julie's data strongly suggests that even just a little bit of long-read data can drastically improve your assemblies with short-read data. So that's sort of... Do folks understand that question, which is like, is it possible to combine the two data sets in order to improve one without having to spend, you know, 40 smart cells worth of costs on sequencing with only one data type? But in a perfect system, if you could assemble these, right, in this system, we were able to assemble almost a complete bacterial genome on a single contig here. So this is the max contig length. And then in blue here is the N50, where you're seeing that 50% of your sequence space is larger than contigs of this size. So the molecular assembly really did not perform particularly well, but those data are really beautiful for looking at strain variation because you have 20 kV pieces that each came from an individual piece of DNA in the environment. So even if you can't assemble them further, they're very useful for looking at that type of population variation. And the other point that I wanted to make here about this contig. So it looks like, okay, it's maybe not, there, I mean, this is a jump, right? But even still, you had a 500 kV contig in your short read assembly. And the thing that I think is important to highlight about that is that this is not one of the most abundant organisms. It's one of the most clonal organisms. So this is a sort of minor constituent alpha proteobacteria that just happens to have much less population variation than everything else. So the short-read assembler was able to handle it much better. So sort of a word of caution in interpreting short-read metagenomic assemblies, the most beautifully assembled thing is often not the most abundant. And part of the reason that our initial assemblies had been so fragmented was that we do see a fair bit of population variation and structural heterogeneity in these populations.
Sorry.
Yes.
But the longest contact of each platform was always from the same organism?
No. The longest contact of this platform was not the same as the longest one in these two. In both of these, it was the purple sulfur bacteria, which is the most abundant. The longest contact from the purple sulfur bacteria, I think, was maybe 100 or 200 kV in the short read data. So it really emphasizes that the short read assemblers perform beautifully with clonal species, and much more poorly when you start to introduce population variation into those genomes, particularly if that population variation is structural. So you have a gene insertion, right, or a CRISPR, or things like that. Those really mess up the assemblers in those cases.
What about the percentage of repeats in these species, or the length of the repeats, so that short reads might not cover?
Yes, that is also a great question. That's something that, if you are interested, I would love for you to look at, because I have not actually looked at the repeat signatures in these genomes. But so that easily could be part of it, is that they have more repeats as well.
Short reads are terrible.
Any more questions before we keep going? Okay. All right. So I have a story on binning and an approach that I used on binning. And in the sake of time, I'm going to give you the punchline, which is that using the PacBio platform, we were thinking about this question, which is that bacteria can identify their own DNA, right? And the way that they do this is they use restriction modification systems to methylate their DNA at particular sites. Right? And what they do is they use this to distinguish self from non-self DNA, and then they have restriction enzymes that chews up that non-self DNA. Right? And so one of the interesting features of the PacBio data is I was interested if we could use that to tune into these signals. All right? And so the PacBio data can recognize methylation signatures because there's a kinetic component to that data. So as it's read in at the bottom of the well, it detects this fluorescent flash. And if there's a modification on one of these bases, here it's shown like that, what happens is that you see a pause. So if you compare the space here in time between these fluorescent flashes here, these two are right next to each other. This one has a much longer pause. And this is a signature that they've worked out on that platform that corresponds to a methylation event on that base. And so this lets you detect, then, methylation signatures from restriction modification systems in populations from natural DNA. And you need to get enough coverage in order to be to identify it. But so we were interested in whether we could use this as training data and use those signatures essentially as a fingerprint to pull those apart in our DNA. So we identified these modification signatures in a handful of seed contigs. You could either do this with a reference genome. In our case, we used it with a few big contigs that we knew what it was. And then we used that to classify the rest of the contigs based on these sort of unique modification signatures that were present. And I'm going to skip through this data, but essentially it worked nicely. We were able to get it into two bins and then three bins. This is work that I did with Meredith Ashby. And then we were able, in some later work, to further refine this final bin. So it seems to be a very nice way to pull apart some of these different things. And this is a sort of completely orthogonal way to all of the different binning methods that are sort of out there now, which either do what you said, right, where they compare it to a database, or they look at sequence composition like GC content or tetranucleotide frequency. Yes?
I would have thought that the first thing that you use is SNPs. Why do you need to go to methylation? I'm just very
confused. So okay. So to bin things, right? You're at the level of you don't even know who that contact belongs to, right? And so you're trying to figure out, does this belong to species A or to species B, right? And you have fragments of the genome, right? And so you could either look in a database and say, it looks like relatives of species A, right? Or it aligns to something I know with species A, which would be looking at SNPs, right? But what if there's nothing in the database that looks like it, right? Then you're sort of up shit creek because you have nothing to compare it to. So that's when you get much more into the realm of looking at composition. So things that it's made of. Does it have 58% GC or 10% GC, right? Does it have a tetranucleotide frequency that distinguishes it? And that's something that comes out of the codon usage bias from different organisms, which leaves sort of a compositional fingerprint on that DNA. And so again, one of the things I'd emphasize is that our databases are bad, They don't have everything in them. And so when you're trying to classify what something is, if you've never seen anything like it before, how do you pull it apart from the other things? And so there's some very interesting sort of clustering and classification algorithms that are based on composition. And our thought was to use methylation as like yet another piece that you could use. And there's a number of different, we could spend the whole afternoon talking about binning methods. But basically, anything you can use to get unique information about that DNA fragment that'll link it back to something is helpful. I mean, maybe someday we won't need it because we'll just read the whole thing off the nanopore and this will be defunct. But I look forward to that day. This is a pain in the ass. Yeah.
I just think it's interesting how using the methylation state could reveal horizontally transferred regions, whereas any of the, you know, less like kind of binning methods, you would miss those.
Yeah.
Is that something that you looked at?
We haven't looked, when I saw your slide about looking at horizontal transfer, I was like, we should run that. We haven't done that. We need to look. So we haven't done that. I spent a lot of time looking for transfer events because I didn't have that many other good genomes from these. From the long-read data, I really assembled two beautiful genomes for the purple sulfur and the sulfate reducer. And I spent a lot of time thinking about, was there any evidence of horizontal gene transfer in between those two species? And I have not found any evidence for that in the genomes that I have. Whether there's been horizontal transfer in from someone else, I do actually have an example of that. I can show it to you. Yes, so we do have a horizontal gene transfer event for the sulfate reducer that is pretty cool physiologically. But we haven't done it systemically. That was just sort of a one-off. And then strain variation. So what I wanted to show you here, and I will finish with this, this is an assembly graph, and you can't see it with the current resolution. But the outline here is made, this, if you blew it out, would be a complete circle. The only reason it has these little membrane invaginations is that it needed to squish to fit into the screen. But so each of these is a black dot, and each of those nodes is a DNA fragment. And each edge that's in between them represents an overlap. So assembly, the basic process of assembly between these, forming the backbone of your circular genome for the purple sulfur bacteria. And the different colors that you see here are the fact that it's made up of 9 major contigs, which our current version of the assembler refused to join because it was like, this is messy, I think I should break this. But if you look at the overlap graph, you can see that it in fact forms this sort of closed genome that's 8.5 megabases in size, which is really pretty huge for a bacterial genome. It's about 1.5 megabases bigger than anything else in its family. And part of that has to do with the number of mobile genetic elements and CRISPRs and phages that we find integrated into its genome. And one of the really interesting things are these little bubbles. So the question, right, is it closed? And I would say it's not closed, and I haven't spent a lot of time trying to join each of these ends because it is a natural population. It's sort of open for business. And one of the cool things about these bubbles is if you zoom in on them here, so this is one contig, and then there's another one where you see a read that instead overlaps in this direction, right? And what we're pretty sure these are structural variants. And if you look at the gene content in these area, so this is an alignment of those two contigs to one another. And in the red, you can see regions where these align. And then in the white, this is an insertion event relative to the other one. And all of these genes here are transposases. That are mapped very nicely, and you can map it to SNPs on either side, some of which have this insertion and some of which don't. And so we think this is showing us regions where you have these hot spots for transposase activity in the genome, which is particularly interesting in terms of their ability to catalyze horizontal gene transfer and other things like that.
What were the colors in the graph?
The colors here are the contigs that the Celera assembler assigned. Yeah, so it's not one contig, if that makes sense. So there's a couple levels. So the Celera assembler says, I see a path to assemble these, but if you zoomed in here, you'd see like a little tail that sticks off the side. And so the assembler broke it into those 9 separate contigs. So in some ways, it's not that important for this graph, but it does emphasize the fact that some of the newer generations of strain-aware assemblers or diploid-aware assemblers are going to be really exciting for sort of improving some of this fact that it didn't think it should keep assembling this whole thing, where clearly there's a path to assemble it nicely. Any other questions? Okay. So, you know, we're doing a couple of other things looking at this. This is showing you a region where you have a CRISPR array. which, if you're not familiar with it, is a series of direct repeats here that are shown in these blue bars. And then in between, you have spacers, where it samples foreign DNA and then is able to raise a response to degrade that DNA or RNA when it sees it again, sort of a bacterial immune system. And one of the things you can see just with a very first look at the data, these are the molecular reads, which are very, very accurate. You can see that we see variants in the spacers that are present. So some are shared by all the members we sampled from the population, whereas others either are missing or have different insertions at those different sites. So this is showing you really population-level variation here in terms of the things that they've seen in foreign DNA or viruses. So this is an area where... So this is an area where I had some students working on a project. David was in the same group as Audra, who's continued working on this summer and ended up losing to Jill Banfield's lab in the fall. But she's been working on mapping out the predator and prey arrays. So taking those spacer sequences that you see here and saying, can we find anything that that matches in the metagenome? So taking those short sequences and trying to find the viruses that they match and then see who else does that virus infect and looking at that sort of network of feeding. And so this is showing you in the colors are the bacterial genomes and their CRISPR arrays we found. And then these other dots, we're looking at the viruses that they might be targeting and trying to map that pattern of cross-infectivity. And then something that I found just recently paging through the data, thinking about viruses and things that they interact with, was this other region of variation. This is a beta antigen gene, which is a sort of a cell surface protein. And what you can see here in the PacBio and then also in the molecular data is that you have a wild number of variants. So this assembly, the reference assembly was done from the PacBio data. If we look at this different biological sample, you can see that there's been a complete change in the middle of this protein. So we've got a lot of heterogeneity. And I don't have any more data to back this up, but it's interesting to me that we see this type of variation in cell surface receptors alongside clearly evidence that there's a lot of phage infectivity and pressures in this population. So anyway, this is why I'm quite so excited about this data in terms of ecological directions that you can go and things that you might be able to see if we're able to sequence them. And I'm not going to talk about this last thing, but this was an example where we saw, okay, maybe I am, So this was our horizontal gene transfer event that we found in that one gene of an interesting rhodopsin protein. And with that, I'm going to stop and happy to take any more questions or let you guys go have coffee. I did try and let you go have coffee, so I tried.